Welcome to Rediscovering Earth's Lost Topography podcast. Today, I have a special guest, Dan Zerlinga, with the Missouri Department of Conservation.
Well, thanks for having me. Yeah, my title is Media Specialist for the Missouri Department of Conservation St. Louis Region. So I do basically what that means is I do media relations, public relations, and communications for our St. Louis region, which includes St. Louis City, St. Louis County, and eight surrounding counties comprise our St. Louis region.
So how wide is the region?
Yeah, so the St. Louis region for MDC includes, like I said, St. Louis City, St. Louis County, but also includes St. Charles. It also includes Lincoln County, Warren County, as you mentioned. It also includes Crawford, Franklin, and Washington counties. So those are all of the counties in our and Jefferson County.
Oh wow! So you mm-hmm. You got a wide band.
Well, so here's the irony of it. I've got several counterparts across the state that do what I do, and so the St. Louis region, the geographical footprint is actually smaller than most regions. Most of my counterparts have more counties and stuff than I do. But, of course, St. Louis is the most populous region in Missouri. So that's one reason why that kind of makes up for it. And I've always liked to say, people require more service than acres do a lot of times. So that's one reason why we have the smallest geographical footprint in St. Louis. But we do have by far the most people.
Okay. And is the main headquarters, you got a headquarters out at Bush and also as well as like Powder Valley. Is that correct? Is that two of the main?
So those are two of our main office sites, yes, where we have staff and resources there. The August A. Bush Conservation Area also holds the St. Louis Regional Office. So that's our hub for the entire St. Louis region I just mentioned. That's our main office. Then I guess if I would say our second main hub would be Powder Valley Nature Center in Kirkwood. And we also have a lot of staff out of there. But we also do have some other smaller offices and facilities throughout the region as well.
Okay. So out at Bush, is that basically like a museum kind of like as well as Powder Valley? Or is it more of just a straight office to where you guys work out of? Or is it a good place for somebody to come by and visit and see?
Yeah, so the Bush Conservation Area, the regional office there, it's mostly an office, but it's a public contact office where folks can come in and get questions answered, buy permits, buy items like calendars and so forth. But we do have some displays there also. So we do have some interpretive displays where people can see different things about the area and about conservation in general. Then Powder Valley Nature Center is a lot more in terms of displays and exhibits. It's much more extensive than what you have Bush Conservation Area. Powder Valley, you can also go and get questions answered, buy permits, et cetera. But they have a full gift shop there, so all of our gift shop items are available. And as I mentioned, they have much more extensive exhibits. So it's more of a museum type thing than the Bush Conservation Area is. So most people, when they come to the Bush area, they're coming to go outdoors. You know, go fishing or hiking or bird watching or hunting or whatever they're going to be doing, and not as much to do indoor stuff. Whereas at Powder Valley Nature Center, we do have trails for people to walk and they can bird watch and hike and all that stuff. Not really so much any hunting out there considering where it is. We do have a managed deer hunt usually in the fall, but there's no real fishing opportunities there. But a lot more people come for the exhibits and the indoor stuff at Powder Valley than they do at Bush.
Okay. At Bush, where I've gone fishing plenty, Lake 33 is one of my favorite lakes. Lake mm-hmm. 34 is another one. Is Lake 34, that's the one where you have the one lake, and then you can just walk around the corner, and then there's another little pond back there. Is that Lake 34?
I believe that's what you're talking about, yes. And so it's like, I believe, our second biggest lake, and then 33 is the largest lake.
Okay.
And there is, if you go to Lake 33... there is an opportunity also if you go and there's a drive on the, let me make sure I got my directions right, on the east end of the lake where a lot of people will fish and stuff. But if you, there's a little roundabout that takes you down a hill and up again along the lake. But if you make a right instead of going a left on the lake, you'll come to the Darden Creek Trail. And that's a really nice trail too. So you can get back there and see a cool creek and stuff.
Nice.
Yes.
I know Dardine Creek is a very long creek.
Mm-hmm.
I've fished Dardine Creek, trying to think of what the name of that park is in St. Charles. It's a paid fishing lake. I don't think it has to do with the conservation. I'm sure the conservation stocks it, but it's primarily a trailer park. Lake. Are you familiar with?
You're not talking about 370?
Yes.
Yeah, 370 Park. Yeah, so I'm not sure if we stock that one or not. So if we do stock a lake, the stipulation for us stocking lake is it has to be open to public fishing for no charge.
Okay.
So we don't stock private lakes and things like that. So in order to stock a lake, we have to have that stipulation in place where the public can fish there, because we are a publicly funded agency. And so we put, taxpayer resources are going into producing and stocking and managing these fish. So we need to make sure that's open to the public to take advantage of that resource too.
That's awesome. Dardine, since that travels through, I guess, several conservation areas, that's in actual bush area. That's going through the bush conservation park.
It does. It goes through the bush conservation area. Yes. So there's a portion of it that does. Of course, as you say, it's very long and it goes a long way in that area, but part of it does go through the conservation area.
Mm-hmm. Is that floatable up there?
Not really so much. It's not very high. I mean, you can do some fishing and some exploring and great for frog and toad habitat. But yeah, I've never seen it very high where you could actually float it.
Okay.
And maybe it does get a little high after a super heavy rain, but it's not something that you could depend on to float. No, unfortunately. Gotcha. So there's the St. Charles County Blue Way that they're working on. I believe it starts or goes through that 370 park. And so that's basically a creek waterway. It may involve the Dardan too. I'm not exactly familiar with it, but it is basically something that St. Charles County Parks is developing for people to float.
Okay.
And they even have stations, essentially giant vending machines for kayaks, and you can get a kayak and a paddle and a PFD, and you can float and just return the kayak back and, by a certain time. It's like checking a book out of the library, So, not overnight. You can't take it overnight, but for several hours or for a day or whatever, you can do that. And so that's kind of a neat resource. And that's still, a work in progress. They've got a couple of phases out open, but I think they want to open some more phases too, eventually.
That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bush also has like a shooting area, correct? Like a shooting range?
Yes, it does. So there's the Bush Conservation Area. And so if you're coming down Route D from, say, Highway 94, if you're going west on Route D, to the right is where the entrance, about 2 miles past 94, is where the entrance is to the Bush Conservation Area. And that's where most of the fishing takes place. And we've got some hiking trails and bird watching and all kinds of stuff. That's where most of the fishing is. We do have some other fishing lakes along 94, a few. But then if you keep going about another 3 miles, you'll come to the August A. Bush Shooting Range. And that will be a left off Highway 94, assuming you're going west. And, yes, we have rifle, pistol range. We have trap and skeet for shotgun shooters, shotgun patterning. We've got an archery. Plus, we have programs there. People can come and learn stuff about shooting and hunting and archery and all kinds of stuff.
That's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
That's something I have to actually get my son into.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, I know Bush has a huge history behind it. One thing I noticed, which actually starts way before 1947, but I didn't know, and correct me if I'm wrong, but Alice Bush, the wife of August Anheuser Bush, actually helped the conservation department purchase that plot of land. Is that correct?
That is true. And that's why August Bush's name is on the area, because his widow, Alice, purchased it, gave us the money or part of the money or a significant portion of the money to purchase the area. And she wanted it to honor her husband. And so that's why we have his name on the area. But actually, as we were talking earlier, the history even precedes that point. That's when we acquired the area. But the reason we acquired the area kind of goes back even farther, and to pre-World War II. And prior to World War II, those areas in that part of St. Charles County were very rural, and there were several small, I guess you would basically call them farming communities, like Howell, Tunerville, and they were in Hamburg. So they were these small farming community towns. And then there was, of course, a lot of farmsteads and stuff all around the area. And so that's kind of how things were up until about 1940 or 41. And obviously, we all know what happened those years. World War II broke out. United States entered World War II. And as a result, we needed a lot more ammunition, a lot more stuff to for the war effort. So basically, what the federal government did is they looked on the map of the U.S. and they said, we want somewhere to put an ammunition plant. We need to make ammunition for this war effort. So they wanted something sort of in the middle of the country. So again, it would be protected from possible attack, a bit more protected from possible attacks on either coast, and something centrally located so they could get stuff out, you know, either coast. And they wanted something that had good access. And at that time, the Kansas-Texas Railway was still in operation. Now it's the KD Trail. But back then, it was an active railroad and went through the area right by it. And the river was there, Missouri River. And they had just a few years earlier built the Daniel Boone Bridge on Highway 40. So now there was highway access. So here was this spot, middle of the country, rural, with all these access points. And they determined that's where we need to build our ammunitions plant. So basically, the government came in. They did sort of do an eminent domain thing. Bought out most of those landowners there, and they were, of course, they needed to move then. But then the government basically destroyed the towns that were there, leveled it, and built the Weldon Spring ammunition plant, a munitions plant. And it was like one of the largest munitions plants in the entire country. And so it built made TNT and DNT for the war effort. And, of course, this lasted during the years of the war. And then once the war was over, that land was no longer needed for that purpose. So the basically the federal government started disposing of that land by selling it to other entities. And they had this nearly 7,000 parcel or acreage for sale. And so the Department of Conservation identified it as a really good parcel of land to buy. And since it was somewhat near St. Louis at the time, so they wanted to buy it, and that's where Alice Bush came in and provided the money to purchase that from the federal government. So that's how we got the Bush Conservation Area in 1947. So there were other parts of that land, too, that the federal government needed to get rid of. So they sold some of it to the Francis Howell School District, and that was used to build Francis Howell High School. They sold some of it to St. Charles County, and they built a shooting range. They also sold a large, about 8,000-acre portion to the University of Missouri, and they were using it for agricultural studies and stuff. And so that's kind of what happened there. But then eventually, decades later, the University of Missouri sold their portion of the land to the Conservation Department, and then from that 8,000 acres, we created Weldon Spring Conservation Area. So that's how that came to be.
I used to always wonder, Weldon Springs, the name Weldon Springs, how did it get its name? And then when I ever was talking to a buddy, he actually took me to actually Weldon Springs, where mm-hmm. the water is actually coming out of the side of the hill.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty awesome. It is really cool, and it's below the church. Actually, it's across the highway
mm-hmm.
from Weldon Springs. Is that correct? Is that the spring that Weldon Springs? I mean, I know there's a sign there, which is down in that you have to go down the steps.
Mm-hmm.
Normally you park in that parking lot and then you walk around, go down the steps, or you can go over the hill and go down. But you still have to go down a bunch of steps to get to it. And then there's a sign there that actually says Weldon Springs, and it's the actual spring. You see it. Mm-hmm. There's watercress that was there. This has been years ago. I don't know if it's still there. I'm assuming it is.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the spring that this place was named after, or is that not the spring that it was named
after? I believe it is. I don't know that for certain, but I believe that's where it's got its name. Yeah. And it's interesting where things get their name, and sometimes it's kind of gets obscured with time too, you know. But I believe that is the case there with Weldon Spring.
Yeah, and is there quite a few springs out there? Or is that basically the only spring that's in that vicinity?
You know, I'm not sure if we have a lot of other springs out there or not. Part of that area is designated as a natural area, which means it's, you know, a highly pristine, you know, example of a good ecosystem or pre-settlement, how things were pre-settlement wise. Not the whole area, is it? But there's a portion within that area that is designated as that. And it's got excellent trails and stuff. And as you mentioned, they are a bit more challenging. So for folks like a challenging trail, longer trail, that's really good, you know, some really good hiking there. We have two different, there's the Lewis and Clark Trail, which on the east side of the highway near Highway 40. And it's basically two interconnected loops. One is about 5 1/3 miles and the other is about 8 1/3 miles. So you have your choice of which one you want to do. Couple of nice overlooks along the way, nice varied habitat, a few hills, get your heart pumping a little bit. So that's really cool. And then if you go on down the road another several miles, there's another access called the Lost Valley Trail, and that's about 10 miles, 10, 11, something like that. And that is open to, and that's on the right side, which would be the west side of the highway. That one has actually opened to mountain bikes too. You can mountain bike that one.
Yep, I have mountain biked that trail multiple times. In fact, one of the really cool things, my wife and I have done a lot of mountain biking. We went there, this has been years ago, but there was a sign up, and when you park in that gravel parking lot, and then we started riding down the trail, and we seen a couple signs for spotting a bobcat or bobcat spotted in the region. And then when we got down to the end of that straight line, there was a conservation officer down there walking back. And he actually told us that the bobcat was recently spotted. Is bobcats fairly common in that area, or...
Yeah, I mean, bobcats are fairly common in Missouri in general. I myself have actually seen one on Bush area, which is, of course, close by. And, yeah, so they're fairly common. A lot of times people get those mixed up with mountain lions, which are two different critters. Bobcats are common. They're, you know, have reproducing populations in Missouri. They're pretty widespread. Mountain lions, on the other hand, we have no evidence of any reproduction happening. We're not stocking them. They do appear that they might be in the early stages of recolonization. Mountain lions were indigenous to Missouri, and due to, you know, basically human hunting and so forth, they were extirpated or made extinct from Missouri. But they do seem to be coming back in from the west. When we do find one that we can get genetic samples on, whether it's a carcass or hair or whatever have you, we can trace those back to South Dakota, Wyoming, Montana. They seem to be coming in from there. And so, you know, it's possible that we'll eventually start seeing breeding populations here. We have no evidence of that so far, i.e. breeding would be seeing cubs, that sort of thing.
Yep.
But we did see an evidence. Most all the individuals that we have been able to get DNA on are all male. Obviously, it takes two to tango, so, you know, but we did see evidence, one genetic evidence, that we did at least at one point have a female in the state.
Oh, nice.
Yes, there was an elk kill in, I believe, Shannon County, and when they did the DNA around the, you know, where the wounds were, they discovered DNA for a female mountain lion.
Wow.
So, does that mean breeding's going on? Doesn't prove it. It just means there was a female here at one point. You know, we have yet to see what that's going to happen, but we're thinking that could be a possibility down the road that we'll eventually see. But so far, we have not seen any evidence, but we have definitely seen an uptick in sightings, confirmed sightings,
that's
over the years.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. That is really cool. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you brought that point up, because I've brought up in previous podcasts, I bring it up to quite a few people, because in your profession, you know about bear in Missouri. And the different wildlife that's in Missouri. One thing that kind of frustrates me is the fact that all these people, like Wildwood, for example, just using that area as an example, there's a ton of them. But all these people saying, oh, we built this beautiful garden in our backyard and the deer's jumped over the fence and came and ate it.
Mm-hmm.
And they get so frustrated about it, or they're like aggravated about it. I built this beautiful, beautiful flower bed and the deers came by and ate it. And I just watched them out my back window.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't understand. They're like, I'm not quite sure why they keep coming to our place. Well, it's actually, they didn't come to your place. You went to their place.
Well, that is a very important thing to consider, because a lot of people may not be thinking along those lines, but you're absolutely right. So that's one challenge of conservation, is as we expand our suburban sprawl and all that, we're getting more and more into wildlife's space. And there's going to be more interfacing, more interactions and stuff like that. And yes, people do have to realize that they have moved into a place that was once the total purview of wildlife, and the wildlife doesn't disappear just because they moved there. So, I mean, it's a double-edged thing. I mean, if you're moving out to the country or to a rural area to enjoy the, you know, trees and the solitude and the peace and the wildlife, that's great, but you have to understand there's also some other things that are going to happen. They're going to eat your, you know, your flowers, or there may be a raccoon in your trash can or whatever. So those are all things that you have to kind of, you know, give and take there a little bit. It's like, can't buy a car without a car payment. And, you know, if you enjoy driving the car, that's great. But end of the month, there comes that payment. And so there's the same kind of principle. Or you got to put oil in it or tires or whatever. And it's kind of the same thing with moving out into those kinds of areas. So, you know, the best thing we can suggest is, you know, you can build fences. Sometimes there's some deterrent things that you can do. You can try to condition wildlife to stay away, you know, by, you know, harassing them when they come and stuff like that. But it is going to be some work, and you have to decide whether you want to put that work into it. And there's no guarantee that it's going to be a magic solution.
Correct.
You know, so, and one option, and a lot of people don't like theirs, but one option is just don't plant that garden.
Yeah, that's
going to get eaten. And so enjoy nature, enjoy the wildlife, and save yourself a lot of money on planting stuff. And if you do plant it, understand that there's going to be that maintenance and that challenge.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like my one buddy, he moved out to High Ridge. He planted an above ground garden. And prior to that, I mean, his yard is small.
Mm-hmm.
But prior to that, he wasn't seeing much wildlife. Now that he has an above ground garden, he's got tons of wildlife. So he put mm-hmm. up a fence around his property that doesn't stop deer from coming in and in his garden. He basically kind of shoos them off and stuff like that. But yeah, I always tell people, you know, that say this kind of stuff, it's kind of crazy, because they say that, you know, the wildlife is coming into our area. And I'm telling them that area doesn't belong to us.
Mm-hmm.
That area actually belongs to the wildlife. We're going into their area, not the opposite. Mm-hmm. And the more and more I see, like driving down a highway where it used to be nothing but woods and farmland, and now going out, I can't remember exactly where it's at, but these fields that used to be there where you could see nothing but field forever, now they have an entire subdivision being built up on the one side of the highway. And I look at that and I know automatically that those are going to be some people that are going to complain about wildlife. Well, it's... again, it's not the wildlife's fault. And mm-hmm. I disagree with the fact, like, when people say, oh, well, we got a mountain lion running around our neighborhood, or we got a bobcat, or we got bears or whatever. It's not their fault. It's, mm-hmm. I mean, it's our fault for building properties where these places are at. And again, you just mentioned it. I mean, my one buddy that moved out to the woods, he moved out there. He lives on a lake. He has a huge lake. And he moved out there because he loves the woods. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't build a garden and all that kind of stuff. If he does, he realizes that it's going to get eaten. But he has everything. Raccoon, he has possum, he has deer. Mm-hmm. But he has a boat dock right behind his house. Mm-hmm. And he has a John boat. So it's not like a fancy motor boat or anything like that. But he goes out and fishes out there. And I can't remember the name of the lake. But it's really pretty. And it's not far from Bon Terre Mines.
So like in Jefferson County? Yes.
Yep. He's south of that just a little bit. So mm-hmm. I think he's on Jefferson County, Franklin County border.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if, I'm assuming that would be an area that you guys probably stocked that lake. I would almost think, because I know it's completely free to fish there. It's just, you got to find the public access to get to it. There is mm-hmm. beaches and stuff like that around that lake. Mm-hmm. Again, there's also a lot of private property. So you can't just cross over somebody's property just to get to the lake and fish.
Mm-hmm.
And going back with lakes and stuff at Bush, is there 36 or 38 lakes there? Or
I believe there's 38. So now not all of those are fishable. There's some that aren't fishable. And I know one in particular we have for like dog trials and or not dog trials, but for retriever work and things like that, dog training. So, and then we have a few set aside for educational purposes. So only educational programs like schools or scout groups or something can fish there. So the general public can't. But there's still, even with all that, there's still about 30 or so lakes that are fishable for people. So it's, and each lake is managed differently for different things. Some lakes have muskie in them even. Some lakes have, you know, are better for bass or crappie or what have you. So, and then in the wintertime, in a number of those lakes, we stock trout in the cold months. So there's even that possibility of pursuing trout at Bush. So there's a lot of huge variety of fishing opportunities there. There's some lakes that are tiny and relatively small. Some we even actually have walk-in access to, and then some are huge, like Lake 33 and Lake 34. And some lakes we have a vendor that has John boats there that you can rent and go out on the lake, either row or have a small electric trolling motor. And in some lakes, we actually allow folks to utilize their own personal craft, canoes and kayaks primarily, anything you can hand launch, basically. So there's a lot of different opportunities. So if you want to fish from a kayak or canoe or you want to rent a boat, you know, on some lakes, you can certainly do that. So we try to offer a variety of fishing experiences for folks, depending on how they want to go fishing.
That's awesome. And as far as Bush, what time do you guys normally open? Is it about 4 a.m.? Is that correct?
Yeah. So it's one of our, what I call our 4 a.m. to 10 p.m. areas. So it opens at 4 a.m. in the morning. So if you want to get there early and get a start on fishing, or if you are, say, on a managed hunt or whatever, or you're a bird watcher or photographer and you want to get there for the golden hour, you can certainly do that. And then it stays open until 10 o'clock at night. We do have an electric gate there that does close. So if you want to do a little bit of, fishing at night a little bit, you could certainly do that. But you do have to keep in mind you need to be out of that gate by 10 o'clock.
No camping allowed on that property, correct?
No, Bush does not have any camping. We don't have any camping there. We do have some of our areas throughout the region that do offer camping, but that's not one of them. Yeah.
Okay. I know one of the areas I used to camp that was conservation was Reef Schneider. And I'd like to bring that up because I know that I used to camp there on a regular basis and it was gorgeous, peaceful. You cross mm-hmm. over that low water bridge or mm-hmm. actually cross through the creek mm-hmm. and then go up the other side. There used to be little campsites, mm-hmm. Little fire pits and stuff like that. And probably 8-9 years ago, I guess, I went back there with a couple of people to go camping, and it was all shut down. They removed the basically the campsites were all lumbered. I guess mm-hmm. There was a lot of trees down in those campsites, just making it impossible to camp there. It didn't say no camping, but there was no place to camp.
Yeah. I think if I'm not, I'd have to check for sure in the regulations on Reef Schneider. If I'm not mistaken, I believe that may be open for camping for like deer season, for okay. hunting seasons, for hunters primarily. I don't believe it's open at this point in time for camping just year round for anybody to camp. But there is some picnic areas there that you can picnic. And as you mentioned, there's a creek, and that's popular for people to just to have fun and wading. I've seen kids playing in the creek before there. We do have a trail, Lizard Rock Trail, which is a nice, I think it's about 3 miles ish or something like that. Just past, as you mentioned, that, that little water crossing. And, we have a an unstaffed shooting range there. So folks can, bring their firearms and sight them in or practice their, you know, marksmanship or whatever, just kind of get familiar with their firearms, which we always recommend before hunting season.
Correct.
don't yep. buy a new gun the day before hunting season. And so you definitely want to have time to get familiar with your firearm, comfortable with it, and sight it in to make sure you're placing accurate shots. So that's just an opportunity there. The hours are just daylight hours for that particular shooting range. There's no staff or anything there. But the bush shooting range, which we mentioned a little bit earlier, that's a staffed range. So we have full staff there. We have full facilities and everything. And there is a charge for that range. It's like $4 or $5 an hour.
Yeah, it's cheap. It's worth it.
Yeah, it's very inexpensive. Includes paper targets, basic ear protection if you don't have, you know. So it's a pretty good deal. And of course, in these unstaffed areas, there is no charge because we don't have those facilities. You have to bring everything. But it just affords folks a different experience if they want to shoot. But it's like I mentioned, the lakes. Some lakes are big. You can put a boat on. Some are tiny. You can just walk in. Same thing with shooting. We want to provide different opportunities for people.
Yeah.
Depending on and access. If you don't live close to Bush Conservation Area, you maybe live closer in, you know, far, say, western Warren County, then Reef Schneider be easier access for you.
Correct. Yeah. Well, I do like Bush Wildlife Shooting Range, and I like the fact that it's staffed because, mm-hmm. I mean, I've been shooting for target shooting for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I really do respect the fact that you guys monitor the booths,
mm-hmm.
per se. You know, like when you say
actions open,
actions yeah. mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff out. I like the fact that you guys walk through there mm-hmm. and make sure everything's clean and clear mm-hmm. before anybody goes out to, because these open shooting ranges, I think they're great
mm-hmm.
for experienced shooters.
Yeah. So if we're going to make, you mentioned camping. So if I was going to make an analogy, the unstaffed ranges like Reef Schneider, we've got a few others in the region as well, they are for more experienced shooters because you're kind of on your own there.
Yep.
Whereas at a staff range like Bush Shooting Range, and we also have another staffed one, Hinges Shooting Range, which is on Forest 44 Conservation Area there in Eureka, they're better for folks who are maybe unfamiliar with their firearm or might need a little more assistance or guidance and safety measures they should be taking, you know, when they're using their firearms. So it does provide that a little bit more controlled conditions for them. So getting back to the camping analogy, you mentioned camping, and we do have camping in a lot of our areas. Our camping does tend to be the primitive type.
Yes.
So if folks are self-sufficient, they're experienced campers, they got their own water, they can collect their own wood, they can, you know, start their own fire, and they're okay with nobody being around when they're camping, and they're self-sufficient, they're great. If you're the type that would rather have some place to get water, to get wood, to have somebody to go to if you have an issue, have more, you know, facilities, then we recommend going to state parks. Because they have a lot more of those facilities. Some of them have laundry, some of them have playgrounds, some of them have, you know, usually you can get water and everything. So that's sort of the same thing. If you're newer to shooting and you need some more, you know, guidance or assistance, go to one of our staff shooting ranges. If you're more experienced, then you can go to the other ranges.
Yep. And please understand that what the differences are between experienced and non-experienced mm-hmm. to all the listeners out there. Because that's important. I mean, I think education is very, very important for shooting. If you have no education for shooting, I would recommend taking a class. I know the conservation department basically mm-hmm. offers classes for shooting mm-hmm. and hunting classes.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the camping side, you're right. I mean, I've taken people camping, and a lot of people don't like the kind of camping I do, because mm-hmm. the camping I do, sometimes I sleep under the stars. And mm-hmm. I mean, I think that that's awesome. Mm-hmm. And some people, they
like glamping more, maybe.
Yeah, basically it's either RV or SUV or tent. And they think that that cloth material is going to save them from a bear coming up or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, the knowledge has to be there. Again, you mentioned, I mean.
Yeah, so that's a good point. Our camping areas don't have any hookups. So if you've got a trailer and you want sewer and water, electric hookup, we don't have any of that.
Yep.
It's extreme. It's basically tent camping, car, you know, sleep out in the open, sleep in your car, what or your truck. You know, that's kind of, or like I said, a tent. Whereas if some of the, most of the state parks will have areas that you can do that, but they also have areas where you can do, pull up your RV and get full hookup capability. So, and both, there's a place for both experiences. You know, there's times when, yeah, I want all the amenities and I want to pull in my RV and do all that. And there's other folks or other times where you might, you know, I don't want to pitch my tent. I don't want anyone else around but me. And, you know, there's room for both.
Yep.
And I'm glad you mentioned about the firearms too. Yes, we offer a lot of classes about firearms. Firearms is something to be respected, and to and it's like, I look at it this way. If you wouldn't buy a guitar and expect to be a good guitar player without taking some lessons.
That's correct.
And you shouldn't expect the same of a firearm. And the big difference is the guitar is less likely to kill you or somebody else. Yep. So that's why you definitely need to respect the firearm and make sure that you know how to use it and you are comfortable and understand the safety measures that you need to have with it.
Yep. And that's where the unmanned shooting ranges and stuff like that, there is nobody to say, clear, go get your target. I mean,
correct. You do rely on cooperation with your other shooters. Yeah. And that's fine. But like you said, if you're more experienced and kind of more comfortable with your firearm, that's a good place to go. If you need a little more help or guidance, then I would go one of the staff shooting ranges.
Right. And is it Bush Wildlife that teaches most of that?
So we do. If you're talking about shooting sports type things and hunting classes, both of our ranges do that. Hinges does it. Jay Hinges Shooting Range in Eureka, which is off I-44 Antire Road exit. And then the Bush Shooting Range out off 90 off Highway D there near where the Bush Conservation Area, they both have classes. So you can take classes there. They both, sometimes they're redundant. They both offer the same class, you know, so you can take it either place. Some will offer a class, the other doesn't, you know. So it just sort of depends. But like coming up toward hunting season, they'll have classes in deer hunting. They'll even have what we call field to fork classes on how to process your deer and how to field dress it and how to cook it and all kinds of stuff. So it varies quite a bit. And they also have, you know, stuff for like dove hunts and duck hunting and all the various kinds of hunting you can do. They'll have classes and a lot of times mentored hunts too.
So as far as like the deer hunting, is that mostly archery or do you guys allow rifles and which properties? I guess they have to be permitted hunting, correct?
Yeah. So, well, if you hunt in Missouri, you do need a permit.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean like buying a permit. I mean, you have to, do you have to register ahead of time?
So you might be referring to managed hunts.
Yes, that's what it is.
Yes. So, yes, on Forest 44, I'm pretty sure of, and I know for certain Bush Conservation Area, it's managed hunt only. And we have to do that because it's in a highly populated area. Those places are well used by everybody from bikers to anglers to bird watchers. So we have to balance a lot of uses in those areas. So we do have to carefully manage the hunting. And the hunting is, I believe, mostly archery, but there may be some areas in Weldon Spring that you can do firearms too. So a managed hunt process works is you basically, it's a lottery. So you have to put your name in. We only select a certain number of people and designated times at which they can hunt. So that's how we manage it. So it's a little bit more a controlled situation because, again, we have other uses on those areas. Whereas if you got into the more rural areas, we don't have that. You can just, you know, with the appropriate season and all that, you can go out and hunt, you know, within the allotted hours and stuff.
Okay. And you guys have a website. The Missouri Department of Conservation has a website that actually states what is in season, what's not in season.
Yes. So we have mdc.mo.gov, or you can do missouriconservation.org. Either one, you'll get there. And yes, we have all the information that you would need to determine what hunting seasons are open, what species are, you know, open for hunting, where you can hunt, methods, dates, limits, all that stuff is on our website. And you can also get that too through publications that we'll have at any of our offices, MDC offices, or most permits retailers will have that information there too, where you would buy your hunting or fishing permit.
Okay. And does that actually tell you whether you can use single projectile or whether it's shotgun only, or?
Yes. So that's, that will tell you, those resources will tell you those things. And that does vary depending on what area you're on, what game you're pursuing and all that kind of stuff. So, you do need to check those things to make sure you're in compliance with that. But that's, you know, usually you kind of know what you want to hunt and where you want to hunt. So you can narrow it down to those areas and see what, you know, what's permitted in those areas.
Okay.
Yeah. Some are archery only. Like in the more urban areas, it's archery only because obviously it's not practical to be shooting firearms in a highly populated area. But then, of course, when you get out farther out, then we have more firearms hunting and stuff.
And that's, I mean, and getting away from hunting for a second, but actually going back to the hiking part, I know I've gone hiking through a lot of areas, especially in the St. Louis region, but all over Missouri, actually. Mm-hmm. St. Stanislaus, which it's got a beautiful hiking area. And that one spot, you've hiked there, I'm sure, plenty of times. But when you go across that little, like, hanging bridge, and then you go up that real steep climb, and you get up to the top, there used to be a bench up there that you could actually overlook. I don't know how far out you can see. You can see a long ways. That place is gorgeous. And I've done that entire, I guess it's kind of a loop. But recently I was out there, and I don't know if that's conservation all the way around. I know that there is ruins up there on top, but further down the trail, there's some areas that I think it said no trespassing or whatever. I thought I was still on conservation ground up there. But I've seen the no trespassing signs. It's like I stopped and turned around and went back the other direction. I was still on a trail. But are you familiar with where I'm talking about?
Yeah, so one of the things about St. Stanislaus is it's right in the middle of Hazelwood. And there's a lot of there's private property all around it.
Okay.
So it's like a little oasis there, but there's private property all around. And so you mentioned about going over that bridge and going over that steep climb, and then you're in this, I guess the best described is a little trail system, that Charbonneau Ridge that you're on top of. And there's a lot of interwinding trails and stuff there. So you do have to kind of make sure you got a map and pay attention to where you're going, because you can get yourself turned around up there.
Easy.
Beautiful, beautiful hike. And as far as I know, the bench is still there, but it's been a couple of years since I've been there. So the only thing with the bench is, there are a lot of trees there. So if you go in the summer, you may not get as good a view. But if you go in the winter, it'll probably be a little bit better when the leaves are down. But yeah, so there are definitely those does intersect with private property all around there. So you do have to be mindful of that. So I would definitely take a map up there. You know, these days, I got a great app on my phone. I always use it. And so there's lots of apps you can download for free on your phone. And you've got maps and topo maps and trails and everything, or for a small price you can purchase them, you know. So that's a really good resource to have with you. And then another thing, though, you can also, like you mentioned, going up that hill, but if you go, I guess would be left essentially, there's a trail that goes out over an open field and takes you out to a slough in the river. So if you want to access the river, well, it's a slough on the river, I believe, or a little island, but it eventually connects to the Missouri River. So there's that option there as well. And that's a lot flatter. So if you don't want to climb up and down, you know, that's an option too.
Yeah. And that actually does connect with the river. It's a quite a long hike.
Yeah,
but it's definitely connects with the river. You can see a slough, like you said.
Uh-huh.
But if you keep going, and I'm not sure, does that stay conservation area all the way to the river?
I believe it is, yes. Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I know I've fished the slough after you cross over the bridge and that little creek or whatever. I've never had any luck back there. I'm not sure if there's anything that actually comes back there, if it's just fills with after a flood.
Yeah, I don't. I think it's mostly kind of a wet water, a wet wet weather type creek. I don't know. There may be something there, but I would probably think you'd have better luck just if you want to take the effort to go all the way to the river or the slough.
Exactly. I mean, I will say this is I've seen some, and again back to wildlife, but river otter. I've seen river otter down there at St. Stanislaus, especially while I was up on the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
They were playing in that creek underneath the bridge. They were sliding down the banks. I've seen beaver down there. It's kind of weird because I've not seen beaver chew very much down there.
And that might be why there's not as many fish there if there's otters. And that may have something to do with it, but exactly. I don't know, you know. But yeah, it's likely it's good habitat for all those animals, otters and beaver and all that. Yeah.
Yep. And I like seeing the birds and stuff like that out there. I carry a pair of Vortex binoculars with me, and I love birding. So I'm big into like spotting different birds. And what's really cool is you go there all year long and you see birds from every different type. I mean, as they're traveling through, birds stop there. It's almost like a hotel for birds. Just
well, you're right there as the crow flies. You're not far from the river, the Missouri River. And the Missouri River is, of course, connected to the Mississippi River. And the Mississippi River is one of the largest flyways in the whole nation. So, yeah, you're going to get a lot of different birds there due to the river resources, the riparian, which is the areas between the land and the river that border the river. Support a lot of wildlife and birds. So yeah, that's pretty cool. And you mentioned the history aspect. If I'm not mistaken, St. Stanislaus Seminary, I believe, did have a retreat there at one point, way before we had anything to do with the area. And there is a foundation. If you go up the Charbonneir Bluff, up that steep hill, and on along one of those trails there, you will see some foundations from when those buildings were there. So that's kind of interesting to see too. I mean, it's not a grand building or anything. You have to kind of look for the foundation, but it's there.
No, it's there. It's the ruins, I would assume. I've heard all kinds of theories of people saying what they thought it was or whatever, because they actually have the bowl. I'm assuming it probably held water or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's several spots up there. There's even geocaches and stuff like that, which I'm sure there's geocaches probably all throughout all your conservation areas.
A lot of them have them, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was always told that was a retreat. I don't know. There could be some other things that were there too. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, it's old. I mean, it's concrete bowls that I guess I don't know how they made them. And they said that there's a museum behind St. Stanislaus all about the St. Stanislaus area. I don't know. I've never been there, but they were telling us about it, and we met them down at St. Stanislaus, and they said they just came from the museum about St. Stanislaus, which...
Well, there is the down Charbonneir Road farther. There is still the seminary there, I believe.
Okay.
And that may be what they're referring to. I'm not sure. I'm not familiar with what that particular museum. Wouldn't be our museum, but yeah, there's a lot of neat history there for sure.
Definitely. And then, like, Rockwood Reservation, that's loaded with trails. And the trails there go from pretty simple. I think probably one of the easiest trails there is Trail Among the Trees. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, I think most trails there have some hills and stuff. So it depends on what your definition of easy is.
Yes.
If your definition of easy is all flat with no hills or all concrete or whatever, then we do have a little bit of trails there. I think part of that Trail Among the Trees is fitting that description, but then it definitely deviates from that at some point where you are doing some climbing on natural services and stuff like that to get, you know, and then you've got the Lime Kiln Trail and they kind of intersect there, and there's a bit of a climb with the Lime Kiln Trail as well, but you'd have a nice overlook up there, and it's really beautiful hiking, beautiful area, beautiful topography, great forest habitat for anything from, like, this time of year, probably be seeing dogwoods and maybe redbuds. They may be a little finishing now, but you know, great spring birds, all kinds of cool stuff, and wildflowers. And you've got Hamilton Creek there, which is kind of a wet weather creek, but after a good rain, it flows really nice and it's really beautiful. And we have the Lime Kiln there still because that area has a lot of history. Pre-MDC, it was used for various things, for mining, for smelting, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So, and farmsteads were there. Native Americans made use of it. So its history goes way back before the Conservation Department. But the interesting thing with regard to the Conservation Department is that that was the very first conservation area that the Department of Conservation purchased and established and opened to the public in 1938.
Wow.
So that was our very first conservation area. The Conservation Department was formed in 1937, and that was our very first area that we opened to the public.
That is really cool.
That predates Bush, even, by a number of years.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. That's not just the St. Louis area. That's the entire state. That was our very first conservation area.
Really? So mm-hmm. That's very interesting. Mm-hmm. And prior to being taken over by the conservation, it was Cobb Wright Case Mining Company.
Yes.
That ran that area. And I've heard, and you can correct me, I heard that basically prior to the 1938, I'm assuming it was way prior, because they said that they mined that area quite a bit. And in fact, a lot of the trees and stuff were not even there anymore because they did so much mining.
Yeah, there were a lot of trees cut down there, and we still have what's called Cobb Cavern, which is on our rock quarry trail, and that's an artificial cave, as far as I know, where the mining had occurred, and it's gated off now, but you can see that there. And so, yes, the mining was one of the things that was done there a lot. I believe they got limestone from there, and yes, naturally, they had to cut trees and do all that to facilitate the mining operations. But a lot of that has been restored now over the decades. So it's back to primarily forested now.
Which is awesome.
Yes. Yep. Yes. But we still have that there for people to see. And that's all part of the history of the area. The mining was there. The furnace was there. So, yeah, that was an area that was being utilized. Prior to that, there were homesteads there. Hamilton, I believe, was one of the earliest homesteaders, a gentleman named Hamilton. Hence, we have that name represented there in the creek and all. And the Native Americans used it before that. So, yes, it has a rich history.
And see, that's one thing I love about the Missouri Department of Conservation. Not just the Missouri Department of Conservation, but other people that preserve the lands. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, as far as the rules and making it to where... I mean, I know a lot of people don't like the fact that there's rules. I do like the fact that there's rules because that gives access to people. But like the Ladd Foundation, but Leo Adre, which has passed away, I don't remember exactly when. I know the foundation is still in existence. But like, for example, Hickory Canyon, which is now managed by the Conservation Department. Is it owned or managed by the Conservation?
I believe it's owned by LAD Foundation, and we manage it. And okay. So Hickory Canyons is a natural area. I mentioned natural area before. That's because of the unique canyons and so forth there, and because it's got a very unique natural resource. But, yeah, that's a good example of an area that we manage, but LAD owns, if I'm not mistaken. But that's a really beautiful destination, too. It's a little bit more of a drive. St. Genevieve County, I believe it's in. But just, you know, a little ways down I-55. But it's definitely a worthwhile stop. And
gorgeous.
It's yes. Gorgeous. I recommend going there right after a good rain.
Yep.
The falls will be flowing. If it's in the summer, you're not going to see a whole lot of the falls, but the canyons are still really beautiful. And then gorgeous ice formations in the winter on those canyons, beautiful color in the fall. It's pretty much great place to go, no matter what season.
It is. And that's actually a box canyon.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, and you're right. I mean, in the spring when the rains, I mean, now, again, I want to heed caution to anybody that goes out to these places, especially with little kids, because it is a downhill hike in some areas. One thing that's nice since you guys have taken over is there are stairwells, like staircases that go up on the left-hand side for the mile loop, I think.
We do have, so on the, I've got my bad with directions here. I think it would be the east side, right-hand side, I guess, if you're, you know, would be, yes, we have a mile trail on that side, and that includes some wooden steps and platforms. So that does help with some negotiating some of those really steep parts, but there's still a lot of really steep parts we don't have steps on. So yes, it's definitely something that I would recommend you make sure you have. Don't do it in flip-flops, you know. No. Make sure you got some good good boots on, and even just as important as your boots is your socks. So make sure you got good, and you know bring some water, hiking pole or hiking stick or something if you're so inclined, and be prepared for a little bit of a hike. But it's not very long. It's only a mile, but it is some hills, and so, but it's well worth it. It's beautiful and gorgeous Box Canyon. Like I said, if you go in the fall, in the right after spring rain, you might see some nice water flows. In the winter, you see some beautiful ice formations, wildflowers throughout there, you know, different times. So it's definitely beautiful. And then the opposite side of the road, we have another trail, and that takes you to some really gorgeous Box Canyons too at the end of a creek. So yeah, same thing, water flow in the right time of year. You do have to go, I do stress that you do have to go right after a rain.
Yes.
It's you know, if you wait several days, it's dry.
A trickle.
Or if you go in the summer, it's going to be dry. So you do have to time that. But if you're lucky enough to time it, which I've been fortunate enough to only a couple of times, really, to see that flow, it's really, really neat. It's a beautiful waterfall.
Yeah, I actually took some people from their grotto. I took them down there, and we went on a day that it was pouring down rain.
Mm-hmm.
And that half-mile trail, which has more falls while you're walking around. The mm-hmm. one-mile trail has one big fall.
Mm-hmm.
But the one-mile trail also has a creek.
Mm-hmm.
When you're walking that, make sure that you watch the rise on that creek, because guaranteed to you, it doesn't take much rainfall for that creek to fill up.
And yeah, it's very, I guess what you call it, very reactionary. Really reacts to a big rain, but then it dies down pretty quickly too. So
yes.
But and this is good advice no matter where you're hiking. If you're going to be crossing a lot of creeks and stuff, and you're doing it during a big rain or right before a big rain or whatever, keep that in mind. That's actually happened to me. I was at actually Hawn State Park, which is not far from Hickory Canyons, and that happened to us one time. We big rain, and we had to end up crossing a creek at chest high water, which wasn't the safest thing to do.
Wow.
And so I do what I say, don't do what I did, is what I'm saying. You know, make sure that you are aware of those things. And that's more of an issue for the spring.
Right.
Yeah.
Which creek, can I ask which creek that was that you crossed? You said chest high?
Yeah, or nearly. It was, what is the name of that creek now? Pickle Creek, I think.
Okay.
It goes through Hawn State Park.
So you got stuck on the other side of that? Okay.
We had to, luckily I wasn't by myself, so we could kind of do the lock arms thing and do that, get across. But yeah, it was probably something we should have been a little bit smarter about.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause that Hickory Canyon, we had to basically do the same thing. There was a fallen log and we dropped it across the creek,
mm-hmm.
took some tubular webbing, and one of the people from the grotto went to one side and one of us stayed on the other side and basically held that cord tight,
mm-hmm.
so the other people could cross over the log holding on to the webbing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not the safest thing to do, but I mean, it still got us back across. It definitely has some slick regions. And
I don't want to scare people off. I mean, it's not like mountaineering.
Oh, no.
No. But it's just, you know, just make sure if you use some common sense, wear decent boots or hiking shoes and pole if you want, or trekking poles. And just be aware that you're going to be doing a little bit of steep climbing. Yep. Now, I would be a little bit more cautious in the winter because if you are going to go see those ice formations, there may be slick spots. So definitely be aware of that as well. But if you take reasonable care and reasonable caution and understand you're going to be encountering those things, it's great. It's a beautiful place, and it's not really that bad, you know, if you're just prepared.
Yeah. Well, that's, I mean, we went over quite a bit. And as far as Walden Springs and bush wildlife, those bunkers that are there used to hold like TNT when the Army was actually using them, and DNT, which I don't know what DNT is, actually.
It's a different explosive formulation. I'm not a munitions person, but yeah, they're variations. I'm sure one does something better than the other does, but yeah.
Okay.
You'd have to ask a munitions expert on that.
Yeah, I have no clue. I know what TNT is, but I don't know what DNT is, but I read it in the history books.
Mm-hmm.
But also uranium. Is that, there's a plant down there that they cleaned up and put the uranium into, I don't know, it's a mound that's like 70 feet tall or something like that. Is that correct?
Yeah. So getting back to the history of the bush area, conservation area, we did talk about a little bit of it with the ammunition plant in World War II, making the TNT and DNT and all that. And what they did is they built a lot of earthen bunkers throughout the bush conservation area. Well, it wasn't then. It was their area then. And that was for storing ammunition and this TNT and DNT. And so if you walk on some of the trails or bike some of the trails on the bush conservation area, you'll see these bunkers. And that's what they are a legacy of. They're from the early 1940s. And that's what they were built for. Of course, we're not storing anything like that in there now, but that's what they were originally intended for. So, but their history does go a little bit more in that area. So we talked about how there was a munitions plant, and after the war, it was decommissioned and taken, dismantled, and then some of that land was sold to other entities. Well, a portion of that land was later sold to the Department of Energy. And the Department of Energy built a uranium processing plant on that area. And I believe Wetterau or something, one of the chemical companies in St. Louis actually worked that. And so for a number of years in the 60s, I believe, in 50s maybe, they did produce uranium out of there, purified uranium. And then for atomic bombs. And then eventually they stopped doing that and they closed that down. So by the 1980s, you had an area that was frankly very compromised. You'd had munitions manufacturing, you had uranium purification. So you'd had a lot of things going on there that weren't that great for the environment. So what was done in the 90s and to the early 2000s was a massive Superfund cleanup site. So the Department of Energy designated that as a major Superfund cleanup site, ended up being one of the largest in the country. And so they cleaned all that stuff up, built this giant containment mound, which is actually 150 feet tall, if I'm not mistaken.
Wow. Okay.
And the special containment cell with multi-layers of materials and things like that. And they put it in this containment cell and to isolate it from the environment. So they did a massive cleanup there. And so now it's safe to be there and everything. And they're actually, the Department of Energy, if you drive down 94 South, you will see that mound on the right-hand side of the road. And right at the base of that mound, there's a visitor center that's operated by the U.S. Department of Energy. And it's called the Walden Spring Site, Interpretive Site. And then they have information that tells the whole story of the area, tells the whole story of the cleanup and everything. And you can actually take the steps up to the top of that mound. And I don't quote me on this, but I think I've heard where it's technically the tallest spot in St. Charles County.
Wow.
I don't know, but you know, make sure Google confirms that or whatever. But it is definitely very tall. You've got a really beautiful view. And they've also replanted a prairie there. It's called Howell Prairie. So it's a restored prairie that they're working on. And then the Bush Greenway, which is a huge, greenway for hiking and biking and stuff, goes right through there. Also goes through Bush area some and Weldon Spring Conservation Area. So, and there's also connections to the Katy Trail for folks who want to hike or bike that. That's all intertwined in a big trail system. So, yes, that's a definitely a great place to visit, too, for the prairie, for the view, the mound, and then also for the interpretive historical information in the visitor center there.
So with that being part of the Weldon Springs Interpretive Center, is that something that the Conservation Department owns as well? Or is that, I mean, Weldon Springs, I would assume, is probably a huge area. It's not just all conservation. It's probably everything.
Yeah, so there's a mosaic, I will say, of different public property there. There's the Department of Conservation, Bush and Weldon Spring Conservation Areas. And then there, that particular parcel right there where that interpretive center and the mound is, that's Department of Energy. So the Department of Energy purchased that land way back then to do the uranium purification. And now after the Superfund cleanup site, they built a cell, put everything in there, and built that interpretive center. So now that's their area, and they've done the prairie and everything there too. So that's, you know, federal land right there.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But it does abut a conservation area, and it's all, you know, kind of interconnected. The trail systems are all interconnected with those areas.
That's cool.
So you could be, if you go on the Bush Bush Greenway Trail, you might be going through, you know, Weldon Spring Conservation Area at some point. You might be going through the, that particular area, you know, the Hamburg Trail goes through the Department of Energy land and goes back onto Bush area. So there's it's all intertwined.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. And that's really cool. I just wanted to find out about that because I knew that area was there and I was definitely wrong on the height. I'm just definitely wrong on the height.
I'm pretty sure it's 150 feet. Yeah. Again, double check me on that one. But it's pretty tall. It's just a nice little workout to climb those stairs.
I'm sure.
you know, if you want to get a good workout, go up and down a few times and you'll definitely get a good workout. And then they still continue to monitor. They have a number of well sites throughout that area where they continue to monitor groundwater to make sure it's still safe and everything there.
Okay. Yeah, because what I heard is it's once you get to the top, it's a pretty flat area, and it's very, very, very windy.
Oh, yeah, it can be windy. Yeah, once you get up to the very top, it is flat, correct.
Yep.
And then you can see all around, and yes, it can be windy because you're up
150 feet.
If I'm correct, 150 feet in the air, yeah. So.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. Yeah. So, but no, I mean, I think that people should definitely get out, explore the Conservation Department, explore the areas, find out. I mean, Missouri Department of Conservation, I don't know if you remember Raymond D. Gass.
The name sounds familiar, but no, I don't think I've known him personally.
Yeah, when I was a kid, he was with the Conservation Department, and he actually printed a book, which I still have two copies of. I don't think he's around anymore. Maybe he is. But he printed a book on the hiking trails of Missouri Department of Conservation.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a fantastic book. And I eventually hiked all those trails that was in that book. But now you guys have so many more trails and all that kind of stuff. And it's just something that, again, the website that you mentioned earlier, people can go to that and find out if there's hiking, if there's birding, if there's hunting, mm-hmm. if there's fishing, it tells all the different things. I used to have the Atlas, but the Conservation Department took that away and placed it into computers.
Yeah, so you're talking about the Conservation Discover Nature Atlas, I believe it was called. Yes, and it was great. It was basically based on county plat maps and nice big spiral-bound book, but it became too expensive to maintain and reprint and all that and keep up with. So we're in the digital age now. So you can go to our website, as I mentioned, mdc.mo.gov or missouriconservation.org. They'll both get you there. And then if you go to our main page, there's at the top, there's a Discover Nature tab. Press on the Discover Nature tab, and you'll see a drop-down option called Places to Go. Click on that, and that will take you essentially to our online atlas. And you can type in, you can search by area name, you can search by county, nearest town, or in the advanced section you search, you can do like hunting or camping or hiking, you know, by what you want to do. And it will show you all the areas that you can do that in. And then once you click on those, you'll get full descriptions. You can download PDF maps, driving directions, you know, all kind and all the regulations and what you can do in what area. So that's a really good resource for folks. The other thing is, again, being in the digital age, we have an app called Mo Outdoors. You can download that for Android or iOS, and it, you know, Android Play Store or iOS App Store, or you can download it from our site. And so, and it's free. And then it will also do similar things. You can, it'll use your GPS in your phone to detect where you are. And then you can say, I want to go hiking, and it'll show you all the areas that are hiking available. You can click on it, get a map, driving directions, all kinds of stuff. And another neat quality is that you can download maps, pre-cache them, so that if you go out into an area with no reception, you'll still have the map on your phone.
That's awesome.
And as you walk around or drive around the area, you can literally, the little dot will follow you around and you can see where you're at. So it's kind of a cool map too to have.
That outperforms the book. Although, I mean, I was a huge fan of the book. I think I bought 3 copies of them because I wore them out.
Yeah, I mean, they both have their good points and bad points, and strengths and weaknesses, and it's just a matter of practicality and cost nowadays. Everyone's like that. I tried to find a Missouri State Highway map the other day, and I couldn't find it. I ended up going to the MoDOT site and downloading PDF versions of all the maps. It's just kind of how things are going, and you know, it's great. You can download it on your phone and read it and zoom in and print it and do all that, but there was also something nice about having the paper map. Maybe they still have them some places. I'm not sure, but I know they're harder to come by than they used to be. So, you know, it's just a changing time thing.
I agree.
It's a changing time thing. But, yeah, I have a couple of those older big spiral-bound atlases at home, and they were really neat. I do miss them, I admit. I think that was the early 2000s when we were doing that.
Yeah. And my thing with earlier, you were talking about using, like, a GPS and stuff like that during the podcast, and we were, I have a GPS. I have a Garmin GPS that I will periodically use, but myself, I'm more into map and compass because I always tell people that, you know, GPSs are great. They're like Jeeps. They'll get you way out there. But the bad thing is if they fail, you're paying more attention to that GPS than you are to your surroundings. And that's where I find people getting really, really lost. But like any of the topographical maps, if you buy a 7.5-minute map or whatever, it's not a huge, huge area. Like it's not going to give you – you might have to buy several maps if you're going to a certain area that's large. But with a good compass, the knowledge of using a compass – I used UTMs over latitude and longitude, but I have a UTM grid because basically a UTM will bring you within a meter of the spot you're looking for, where a latitude and longitude mark, that's going to, it could bring you in anywhere from 300, 400 feet from the spot that you're looking for. But I always tell people, carry a map, carry a compass, and don't rely, I mean, GPSs are great, and they're also, smartphones are great. The offline maps and stuff like that, there are several maps that I use that are completely offline. So if all of a sudden your phone loses complete signal or whatever, I have a map on my phone that I don't need any internet service or cellular service or anything, and it stays with me while I'm walking around. And it is a paid version of a map one time buying it, but you can download any maps anywhere throughout the entire and all over the world, basically. I do believe that people should always carry maps, and I know that like Rockwood Reservation used to have that display, that little card or fold flip over
book map
with the maps.
Yeah, we still have those. All of our areas have the trailheads, and the areas have area maps you can access. Now, you know, I got to admit, sometimes they maybe run out or something, and if some folks don't get there to refill it in time, but we do have paper maps for all of our areas, and I personally say carry it all.
Yep.
Take the map, take the GPS, take the compass. They all have their strengths and weaknesses. And the I always like to think of the GPS is great at telling you where you are, but it ain't going to tell you where to go.
Correct.
And that's where you need the map and or where you need to go or whatever. Now, a lot of devices like phones and more advanced GPSs, they're integrated. You have the map and the GPS in that device. And so now you got the best of both worlds. The only thing you have to be sure of is, like you say, don't depend on internet reception to get that map. Yep. Make sure it's downloaded on your device there. And the only other thing you have to concern yourself with is power. Make sure you've got plenty of batteries or your device is perfectly charged or you've got a backup battery pack or something like that. But and then that's why you have the paper map. If that all fails, then you at least have a map and a compass to... And sometimes it's just easier to look at the map than it is to fiddle with your phone. So it just depends on the circumstances. Sometimes the phone's better than fiddling with the map. So it's you know, they're all good to have. They're all, I look at them as three legs of a tripod.
Yep.
Compass, map, GPS.
Yep.
And, you know, if you've got those things, you can probably get yourself out of a lot of trouble.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You know, and a little common sense.
Exactly. A lot of common sense.
Yeah.
Just the thing is, I always tell people that, and even with our grotto, I've told people, you know, they go out with the GPS and the coordinates or something like that, and they're looking at their GPS, constantly looking down.
Mm-hmm.
And I've said to them before, you know what, stop. Greensfielders is a phenomenal place to talk about, because how many people get lost in Greensfielders? You go off trail down into one of these pits, and then you're like, oh, it's going to be easy to get my way back out of here because I'm just going from this gravel road straight down to the bottom. You get down to the bottom, you start looking around, you look back up, you're like, which side did I come down?
Yeah, so you can, I mean, I am not gifted with the gift of direction, so I can get myself turned around pretty easy. And as much as I don't like to admit it, because I love hiking, I love doing stuff outdoors, but I am directionally challenged. And it's easy to get yourself turned around. And I'm embarrassed to tell you that I have gone on a trail, stopped and gotten off the trail for some reason to do something, got back on the trail, hiked for a mile or two, and then realized I just went back over the way I came. I took the wrong turn. And that's why, and then I had to hack that all the way back again. And so, again, having those tools, even if it's just the compass, you can just whip out and go, oh, I'm going north. Yeah, I should be going north.
Yep.
Oh, wait a second. I'm heading south. I don't think I should be heading south. I believe the trail's going northish. You know, that's a good, just a quick reference to see where you're going, you know,
exactly.
Without having to get your, open your app and unfold your map and do whatever. So, you know, and a map by itself isn't that useful. And if you don't have these other tools,
it is not. You're right.
Yeah. I mean, unless you recognize a definite landmark that, oh yeah, here I am. There's the lake. But you know, other than that, if you're in the middle of the woods all look the same.
Yep.
You know,
well, and that's where
at least to me.
No, and you're correct. I mean, a map by itself is not gonna. I mean, that'd be like having a paper without a pencil.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah. I mean, and the same thing that we mentioned in an earlier podcast was with the whistles.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you just mentioned about going off trail, and during that previous podcast, I mentioned to people, you only have to go 50 feet off of a trail, and you may not be able to see where you're at no more.
Yes, you can get lost in less than that.
Yep.
And because once you get off that trail, 20, 30 feet, was that the stump I crossed, or was that the stump? Wait, there's another stump. Maybe that was the stump. Oh, wait, I thought I knew. I looked at the stump, but now there's six stumps. So, yeah, it's easy to definitely get yourself. I mean, some people do have a gift of direction, and they can say, oh, yeah, I know exactly where it is. Turn around and go right back. But unless you're one of those people, you know, you probably ought to be careful. That's one reason why, again, a GPS or a compass is good, because you know, oh, I took off south. Okay, so now I need to go back north to get to the trail. Or you look at my GPS and look at the trace where I went and then go back on that trace again. So, yeah, that's, you know, the map may not help you at that point by itself.
No.
If you've gone off trail 50 feet, you're like, okay, no trail. It's all woods. So, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and that's one thing, like that whistle.
And yes,
I also highly, highly, highly recommend, because if you did go off trail 20, 30, 40 feet, mm-hmm. and you think, well, I'm going to go east because that's the way I just came from, but actually you came west, but mm-hmm. you don't realize, because what tree doesn't look like another pine tree? I mean, it's like these trees start look the same, and you're like, and that's why I always say, look behind you while you're hiking. I mm-hmm. mean, while you're walking, especially when you're off trail, I don't recommend people going off trail unless they're highly qualified.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do, always do it with respect. Don't mm-hmm. smash down anything mm-hmm. that's preserved or mm-hmm. whatever. Always ask permission before you go on to private property and absolutely. Stuff like that. Do not ever go on to private property and not knock on somebody's door. People don't realize that most people are pretty kind.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not when I say kind, I'm not going to say that they always 100% allow you to go onto their property. Some people say, no, I appreciate you trying or stopping by and asking me,
mm-hmm.
but we don't want somebody going back there. And it's like, okay, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, they're certainly going to be more friendly to you if you ask them than if you just go there correct. And they find out later. Yeah. So yeah, that's definitely the case. But yeah, always respect private property. And then you mentioned going off trail, and yes, you have to be a little more savvy to do that. But even staying on trail, there's times when there are trails that are not very clear. Leaves have fallen. You can't see the trail. Maybe there's a fork. There could be a drainage or an animal trail that makes you think it's the trail, but it's really not. So once again, you can still get lost on a trail, staying on the trail. So or lose the trail. Like if you go over a glade and it's rocky and there's no obvious trail there, or maybe there's not a marker for a way. So again, it's always handy to have that. Know at least what direction should I basically be going here, you know?
Yep.
And that might help you, or use your GPS and see, okay, well, where was the last point I knew there was a trail? And then maybe go back there and see if you've gotten accidentally off trail or down the wrong trail or whatever, you can, you know, maybe get yourself out of trouble that way.
And that's yeah. true. I mean, mm-hmm. I've been hiking for years, and I've been on like many, many trails. One of my favorite trails, which is a state park trail, but it's Minnesota Falls Trail
mm-hmm.
at State Park or Tom Sauk Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And, but when you get to a certain point on that trail, because it starts off as asphalt, then it goes to big rocks, then mm-hmm. it goes to dirt, then it goes to nothing but trail. Then mm-hmm. all of a sudden gets to these big rocks and mm-hmm. glades and stuff like that. And at that point, the markers are not real good on the trees. So, yeah. And I have found myself several times getting turned around at that point, because you go what you think is still the trail.
Mm-hmm.
But then all of a sudden it's like, I've been walking this way for 5 minutes. I don't see another point of trail.
Yeah. Glades are always challenging. Creek crossings are challenging because sometimes you don't pick up the trail again on the other side very easily. And so, yeah, there's definitely, even with the trail, you know, you can still get lost or have a hard time discerning the trail. So once again, if you see two paths in front of you and you're like, oh man, which is the trail? Well, get your compass out and say, well, according to the map, the trail should be going northwest. And so this one's going northwest and the other one's going northeast. So I'll take the northwest one is probably where I should be going. You know, so those are little again, compass map helps. If you do have a GPS that does have the trail system on that map, then of course that will guide you as well. But,
yes.
you know, you just don't know any of those things. It's good to have that redundancy.
Yep. Well, I want to definitely tell you, I've had a great time talking with you, Dan, and I definitely appreciate all the time we've gotten to spend together here.
Sure. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully we got some information out to the folks that listen. And again, I want to recommend people to get more involved with the Missouri Department of Conservation. One thing I love about the Missouri Department of Conservation, we get it. My son gets it. It's a conservation book that comes to us once a month.
Oh, the Conservationist Magazine. Yes. So that's free, absolutely, for Missouri citizens. You might as well sign up for it because your tax dollars are paying for it. And it's free, delivered to your door. It's a great resource. It talks about everything about the outdoors and the conservation and wildlife and hunting and fishing and birds and hiking and all kinds of cool stuff in that magazine. Depending on the month and depending on the issue, you can find any of those things in there. So it's once a month, highly recommended. The other resource we have for our younger folks is the Explore magazine. And that's once every other month, again, free for Missouri citizens. And similar to the grown-up conservationist, but this is the kids' version. It's a little bit more kid-friendly, more graphics, more fun stuff like that in there, more pictures. But you know what? We get a lot of adults saying, I get that magazine too. Yep. I read that one all the time. So yes, they're both great resources. They have similar stuff. Just one's a little more catered to kids. One's more focused on grownups, but great things. So in addition to our website, get hooked up with those two magazines.
And I remember, well, you said earlier that you're into photography as well. Mm-hmm. Do you do some of the photography for the magazine?
Not my primary job. I occasionally will contribute some stuff there, but we have two very, very talented photographers who work full-time statewide that contribute the majority of that photography. So that's mostly where it comes from. But occasionally we have some, you know, freelance folks or some other staff contributing, or sometimes we do have to purchase photography if we can't get that from any other source. But mostly it's those two, Napital Pathong and David Stoner. Those are our two photographers. And they're very, very talented. They contribute a lot of great stuff.
There is some beautiful artwork. I mean,
yes,
some beautiful
artwork
beautiful.
Too. Yes.
So, did you say Matthew was one of them?
No, Napital Pathong. He's originally from Thailand, and then David Stoner are our two photographers. And again, do wonderful work. Beautiful wildlife. Beautiful landscape photography. It's just, yeah, I'm in awe of their work.
Yeah.
Yes, yep. It's a beautiful magazine.
Yeah, it is. And it gives great information. So, but yes, again, I just want to make sure that everybody gets a chance to explore the conservation areas. Definitely know the areas when there is managed hunts, because I'm assuming those are shut down then to hikers, correct?
It depends on the area. Some are shut down and some are not. So, yes, definitely, especially as we get into the fall, that's more of a concern. Our spring turkey season, which we are actually, you know, which goes from April 15th to May 5th this year. So those 3 weeks, and that's approximately what it is every year, give or take a couple of days. So that's 3 weeks of turkey season in the spring. And then especially our fall firearm season, which usually begins somewhere in the first week or so of November and runs about 10 days. Those you definitely want to make sure that you're aware of whatever hunting might be going on. Wear hunter orange when you're hiking in those areas. Or if you can just replan your hike to another time so that hunters have that opportunity, because their window is pretty limited. And so those are some things. And we do have other managed hunts for like archery deer and stuff like that. And depending on, again, the area, sometimes they are closed off and sometimes they're not. So,
okay. Because
depends on the use of the area.
Yeah, I did not know that. That's something that, I mean, I'm not a hunter. I fish a lot, but don't have to worry about casting a line and hooking somebody hiking through the woods.
As long as you pay attention where you're casting, you can possibly hook somebody. But yeah, it's, you know, hopefully that wouldn't happen. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. So, but again, Dan, I want to thank you. I know we got a lot of valuable information. Hope to basically have you back later on down the road. Maybe if you want to talk about something else. I know you're very popular as far as seeing you out there on YouTube and the news and 5:50 a.m. I think, right? 5:50 a.m.
Yes, we are lucky enough to have a segment each Friday morning on the McGraw Show at KTRS 5:50 a.m. So around 8:40 in the morning.
Nice.
So yeah, so we have an opportunity there to talk about different things and stuff that's happening. So yep, that's a great opportunity. We appreciate KTRS for hosting us for that.
Yeah, that's awesome. Is there any way that listeners can contribute towards the conservation department or anything like that?
Well, if you're referring to like donations, monetary donations, we don't really take those because we are a state. You're already giving us money every time you pay your sales tax. But what you can do is we have volunteer opportunities. So various volunteer opportunities to help, you know, deliver programs to the public or do things in our areas or whatever. So those, that's one thing you can look into. And of course, help us out by doing the right thing on the landscape. When you do go hiking, like you said earlier, just leave footprints, take pictures, don't leave your trash. If you see some trash, pick it up. Same thing if you're floating on a river. So if you can do those things to help us a lot, and we would really appreciate it. If you're on conservation area, have your dogs on leash. If you're at home, keep your cats indoors, especially now in the spring when there's a lot of birds out and stuff like that. So those are things that will actually help us out, you know, because you're helping the bigger picture thing for the environment and wildlife and our habitats.
Well, that's, and I'm glad you just brought that up, because that is one thing I do want to mention. It's super important. As I mentioned, I do a lot of fishing with my family. But one thing we do is sometimes we'll go fishing, we'll spend a few hours fishing or whatever, and then we'll walk around that entire lake and pick up all the fishing line that people have cut off.
Yes.
You know how many times we've seen like a sparrow hanging in a tree, or a sparrow stuck in a birdhouse because it has fishing line stuck around its leg. So that's something that I think is vitally important, is if you're walking around, carry a mesh bag, carry something with you that you can pick up trash. Because, you know, people say, well, if I pick up this piece of trash, it really doesn't matter because there's still all that trash left all over the place. Well, guess what? If everybody picked up one piece of trash around this place, it would make it a whole lot nicer. Not everybody picks up their own trash. A lot of people leave things.
That's unfortunate, and a lot of times what I'll do is I'll just say, hey, on this hike, I'm going to pick up one piece of trash and pack it out. And, you want to enjoy your hike. You don't want to spend all your time picking up trash unless that's what you're doing. But like you said, just pick up one or two pieces and get it off the trail and get it out of the lake. And that'll make a difference. So yeah, fishing line's a huge thing. Make sure you're responsible with your fishing line. And then if you have the opportunity to get fishing line that somebody else left out of there, then that will be a huge help for wildlife and for us, because then we won't have to do it. So, you know, that's one thing you can help. So yeah, do all those kinds of things, and that will be a big help for us and nature, wildlife, the environment, the whole thing.
Yeah, because fishing line does not deteriorate.
No, it doesn't, and it does trap a lot of animals, and like you mentioned, birds, and we get fishing, you know, birds caught up in fishing line, bald eagles caught up in fishing line.
Oh, wow.
And yes, we've had to rescue them, and you know, or sometimes weren't able to, and you know, so yeah, it's a thing. Definitely the fishing line is a thing.
Yeah. I've seen a goose not far from here at a lake, and it had both of its feet trapped in fishing line, so it couldn't really walk.
Couldn't move, yeah.
Yeah, it was able to fly because I called the wildlife rescue, and they sent some people out, and I also tried to help. But they eventually took care of the situation themselves. I think I don't know if they netted it. Mm. I don't know how they did it because I wasn't there when they finally got it. I did get a call, but they got the goose, and I think it had to have, definitely had to have some medical attention because the fishing line got entangled around its feet and then basically cut into its legs. People don't realize that stuff. They always say, oh, my fishing line's stuck, let's just cut it off. And that's not the way to do things, because even with like plastic bottles, people throw them in the water and turtles might see something in there, stick their head in there, whatever, anything like that. So all that stuff is required. Yeah. So hopefully people take your and my advice and do help clean up not just conservation areas, but the entire outdoor area.
Roadside, state parks, other parks.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. Street sides. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That all helps.
Yep. Cause we do river cleanups and stuff like that. Not the podcast per se, but I have done river cleanups to where we go in and clean up a section of a creek like Dakota Way or the Hoosaw or whatever. You'd be surprised when you go upriver that there's tires people throw into those creeks and stuff like that. And we dig them out. But
yeah, that's one of the big things in our cleans when we do cleanups in our Missouri Stream Teams, a program of ours, and they clean up a lot. And yeah, they end up with tons of tires. And by tons, I mean literally.
Yeah.
Tons. And trash and tires. And yeah, that's a big thing. Appliances, all kinds of things they end up finding and trying to get out of there.
How can people find out about CleanStream?
So moststreamteam.org is a good place to go on the internet to find out about Missouri Stream Teams. They are a organization, the grassroots organization, but they are sponsored by us. And basically organized into teams, stream teams, adopt a stream, like, you know, adopt a road. And they clean up trash. They do water quality monitoring. They do advocacy, education to the public. So, yeah, they do a lot of great work. And we have a lot of, and us, and we partner with other organizations that have huge cleanup events. So those are good opportunities for people to keep their eyes open for those things and sign up and volunteer to help out for those. So, yeah,
that's awesome.
That's if you want to give back, that's a good opportunity.
Yeah, and that's what people need to realize is they need to look at the fact that when they go out to see beauty, help keep it beautiful.
Exactly.
Don't turn it into a landfill.
Yeah.
Don't turn it into a dump. I mean,
absolutely.
So, and respect the land and respect the wildlife and all that kind of stuff. So
we all share this planet.
We do.
It's not just our planet.
No. And that's one thing I'm big on is I've said that to multiple people is I think I mentioned it to you earlier, but, you know, when we build this stuff up and stuff like that, this, even though you buy a house on that land, that does not mean that that land is your land. Even though you own the property that your house is on, yes, but what was there prior to you? And that's why rediscovering Earth's lost topography is, that's one thing we're about, is finding what was here prior to all these properties being here. And it's getting worse and worse and worse as far as population. I mean, there's more and more and more places getting built up.
Well, there's the saying, I've seen it attributed to multiple sources, but roughly the saying goes, we don't inherit the land from our ancestors. We borrow it from our children.
I think it's important. And I think a lot more people should respect that, but I don't think a whole lot of people really look at it that way. They go out there, don't care about what's going on. I mean, any campsite that I go to, whether it be a state park, conservation area, or just out in the woods, I leave it cleaner than it was when I got there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think everybody should be, but everybody doesn't have that same mindset.
Well, hopefully with education and enlightenment, we can change some of that. That's why, you know, it's important to do your land management stuff and wildlife management things and all that. But ultimately, I mean, to pat ourselves on the back, I think we in the education and communication areas have some of the most important roles, because educating the public and informing them of those kinds of things, we can't do everything ourselves. We're a limited agency with only so many people. So we do need the help of everybody else and the awareness of everybody else and the buy-in for everybody else and their support in order to do these things and to be successful. So that's one of the things that where we always are also big on communication and education to folks.
Well, even the red mesh bags that are given out, I think they're potato bags, but those are put out by the Missouri Department of Conservation, are they not? Okay.
Yes, for like when you go on float trips and things like that. Yes, and for putting your trash in. Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think those are awesome. I think more people should use them. I've been on plenty of floats, Current River, well, Hoosaw. I'm not going to go through and name all of them, but I've seen people with those red bags, and I've seen people, I don't drink beer, I don't drink alcohol at all, but the thing is, I have seen people on float trips that have those red bags attached to their canoe, but they still, when they're done with their beer can, they toss it into the river instead of tossing it into their bag.
Yeah.
And then it's like, well, turn around and go back and get it, are.
So, yeah, that's unfortunate, but yep, yeah, so, some people do that.
Again, man, I definitely want to thank you for all your time. I know we've been talking for a while. Hopefully get a lot of listeners that listen to this and
mm-hmm.
take a lot of education from this and move forward.
So, yeah, hopefully we can educate folks and have them appreciate the outdoors and nature more. That's what our one of our big key parts of our mission.
That sounds great.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you, Dan. And I definitely, again, I appreciate it. I want to thank everybody for listening. You all take care, and we'll talk to you next time. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.